Thomas on Red Radio.
For the students, by the students.
Broadcasting live 24/7.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's just hit 4:01 here on Red Radio. Thank you for joining me. I'm excited to be with you. I know I'm not in my usual slot. Today is normally now Best Bits from 4 to 5. But we will be bringing that to you from 5 to 6 today. But I'm very excited to be chatting to someone who has quintessentially defined the radio industry and has left a mark from rugby to radio to the pantomime. He's been around, and I'm so excited to have him join me in studio today. Mr. John Robbie, hello.
Hi, it's great to be here on Red Radio. I'm highly honored.
Thank you for joining us. So, I mean, I'm 17 years old, and you hosted the 702 Breakfast Show for 17 years. So that's my entire life. I was born with you on 702, and I came into my teens with you on 702.
My goodness me. It's certainly been a long time. You're making me feel a little bit old. When you said I did radio and rugby and pantomime, some people would say at times my rugby and my radio were like pantomime.
Yes.
But, that's tongue-in-cheek. It's lovely to be here.
So, I mean, you hosted, I mean, obviously, as we said, for 17 years on the 702 Breakfast Show. I mean, that's a while, especially in morning radio where it's prime time. I mean, how do you keep it fresh, and how do you keep a news bulletin and, I mean, a news show fresh for so long and interesting for so long?
Well, luckily in South Africa, for various reasons, there's always plenty to talk about. Mm. You know, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And it's extraordinary at times. I was lucky enough to visit other countries and listen to their radio, whether it was Britain, whether it was Ireland, Australia, New Zealand, etc. And you realize how trivial the things they were getting excited about often were. I mean, obviously, with the COVID situation now, the whole world is in a very, very serious state. But in South Africa, because of the past, because of the historical times through which we're living, there are always incredible things happening. There's so many good things, but obviously there are so many bad things as well. And people need information. They also need reassurance. And in this age of social media, of fake news, so much rubbish being put out there, the internet, I think that most people need a place where they can go to and know they're going to get honest news and honest opinion. And that's what I always tried to do, and that's what 702 always tried and tries to do. And I think that's one of the reasons why we were reasonably successful. The hardest thing really was choosing what to leave out on a program rather than to put in, and that's rare in the world of radio, I can tell you.
So, I mean, you started your career on 702, joining from when you weren't playing rugby as a sports commentator, and obviously you worked your way up into the show. I mean, how was that whole experience of working your way up, you know, going from grave yard to primetime morning?
It was surreal, really, and involved a huge amount of luck. I finished my rugby, which was semi-professional in those days. It was supposed to be amateur, but we did get some benefits, if I can put it that way. And because that had been my life up till then, really, I was totally, totally focused on rugby. I had to sort of, at the age of 32, look around and find something that gave me a passion. I did have another job, but I wasn't really passionate about it. And luckily, I was a listener to 702, and 702 used to be on a medium wave signal. I think it's hot station now has the signal, or one of the other stations has it. LM Radio, sorry, I beg your pardon. And the signal was shocking, and 5FM just started copying 702 with a marvelous signal. So 702 was in trouble, and they looked at ways to freshen it up. And from America, they'd realized that they often got sports personalities in to do guest shows. And I'd done a little bit of commentary on television when I was injured, and on radio when I was injured on the SABC, and someone suggested me. And the fact I was a listener to 702, to John Burks and Stan Katz and all these legends of the radio station, I was delighted to come in. And I did it part-time at first, doing early morning sport. Then they offered me a job as full-time sports editor, which I jumped at, and I did a little sports program in the afternoon. And this took off. I mean, can you believe it, in those days, There was no phone-ins. People didn't do phone-ins to radio. And we were the first to actually do phone-ins. People who'd been at the game, there were no cell phones.
Yeah, because that was quite radical for the time.
Oh, this was unheard of. And radio was so censored and controlled in the old South Africa, which I'm sure you've read about, your parents have told you about, that they almost didn't trust ordinary people to phone in. And so I got this, and coming from Ireland, I was used to banter and chat and argument and fun. And then, of course, when 702 went to a talk station, they were looking for people who could handle talk, callers, etc. I was, I suppose, maturing, getting more politically aware, realizing there was more to life than sport, and they gave me a graveyard shift, 10 o'clock till midnight. And a week later, F.W. de Klerk stood up on the 2nd of February 2000, opened Parliament, and the world went mad. And I, by luck, was running this little platform where people of all backgrounds, races, whatever, could phone in and give their honest opinion, and it went through the roof. There was a lot of luck involved, I can tell you.
Yeah, because essentially your career was defined. I mean, Stan Katz decided to move 702 from a rock station to talk, and then you were there, and essentially that defined your career at 702 and essentially the breakfast show for many years to come.
Absolutely. I mean, rumor has it, legend has it, that Stan Katz made that decision over a bottle of whiskey with somebody else. But that's Stan, and that's what he did. And I'm proud to say, looking back, that 702 had a real role in getting the country ready for what was a massive transformation. And I know a lot of people are very negative at the moment, but, you know, have a look at Syria, or have a look at Mogadishu, or some of the places in the world where there are dreadful civil wars. And that seriously is what South Africa could have been. So for all the problems we have at the moment, we've come a long way, and 702, I think, looking back, had a role to play in getting people and helping them through the transition. Yeah, I'm proud of that.
And I must say, I mean, for you being in the public eye for so long, I mean, how do you deal with having, I mean, death threats, to be having a whole lot of negative things flying at you from all directions? I was listening to an interview where you said you got this horrible letter and it was signed from a concerned Christian. I mean, was that
I still have it somewhere, and it was this person who dreamed of pouring petrol over me and setting me alight and hearing me scream a horrible death, and I was a communist and this, that, and the other. And as you say, it was signed a concerned Christian, which I think the irony was lost on me, on the writer. Looking back, it was very, very scary. And Eugene de Kock, the apartheid assassin, I met him once before he came out of jail. I was able to meet him because he was doing work with the prisons and the TRC, trying to find bodies of people that he had murdered. Over the years, he went to jail for 20 years, and I met him, and he told me that in the early 90s, he was told by the police to assassinate me, and he was told to assassinate me using a crossbow to send a message, which, you know, is scary, because I was a relatively young married man, my kids were young, but I think, in a way, there was this feeling, I still harbor a lot of guilt from coming over here in the old days and playing rugby. I came on rugby tours here while, you know, people were being oppressed in this country, while there was racial discrimination, while there were dreadful things going on, and I came and played rugby. But as I said at the beginning, I was totally obsessed with rugby. That was my life. But I have to live with that. And I think, looking back on it, that in a funny way, to be thrust into this position where you could make a real contribution, where you could do something to help, to ease people who are frightened from different communities in. And I think I was driven by this feeling that here was this once in a lifetime chance. If the country could negotiate a settlement, and suddenly Madiba came out of jail, people wanted to talk, F.W. Klerk was there, for whatever reason was receptive, whether it was the economy or a general conversion. I think a lot of other people realized there was this one chance. And in a funny way, I think that allowed me internally to atone for what I'd done. Here was a chance to actually make a difference and do something that was right rather than that was wrong. And, you know, I'm sounding like I was sort of deeply analyzing it at the time. I wasn't. I think maybe fate had something to do with it. And so as a result, when these threats came in, I think I also looked at other people, people like Madiba, Walter, who'd been in jail for, you know, 20-something years in those days for just trying to bring about something. So therefore, what was a few death threats? And also at the time, I thought that people wouldn't send you a death threat if they were going to do anything. They'd bump you off. Nowadays, I look back and realize that I was probably a bit naive. And of course, my wife Jenny and my kids, they suffered a lot because people would abuse them. People would at school make, you know, jokes about them and threaten their dad and so on. But looking back, it was all worthwhile. And in a funny sort of way, looking back, it almost seems like a dream. As I said, sometimes it's almost surreal. And it's also surreal how quickly time's passed, because here I am retired from radio, talking to you, a budding young radio personality.
We're in conversation with John Robbie, former 702 breakfast presenter. We are getting your questions through. Someone has come in and said, "Hi, John, I've been listening to you since 2005, and I was wondering, how has it been off air? How's in retirement been since 702?
It's been incredible. It's like 3 years now, and I'm involved in a couple of little enterprises, I call them. But luckily, I also got involved with a company that there was a guy called Lionel Karp on 702. I mean, like a lot of sports people and media people, my financial situation, my organization was a total shambles. I mean, I was laughing about it yesterday with a very well-known businessman. I had everything in a shoebox with invoices, and it was a shambles, and I had no planning or anything. And Lionel Karp, who worked for 702, he sorted my finances out, my pension fund, stuff that youngsters will find very boring, but I promise you is very, very important. And I got involved with a company I won't mention the name of the company. And what they did was they looked after me. So I was able to retire quite early at 61, you know, a few years before my time. And I've been involved in a couple of other little enterprises that have been fun. And I've been playing a bit of golf, and I've got myself very fit again. I'm the same weight I was when I was 17, which is kind of nice. And generally relaxed a little bit and taking it easy but I miss radio at times, but don't miss getting up at 2:15 in the morning, I can tell you.
I was just going to ask you, I mean, 2:15, I mean, that's intense. You say your dog still wakes up. Does your dog still wake up at 2:15?
Well, sadly, my dog has passed on. Oh my goodness, that's so sad. Our dog. But for a while I used to, and then used to just go, oh my goodness, this is wonderful. And now I've discovered that I'm incredibly lazy. I can sleep quite late in the morning. And it was funny, I said it to somebody the other day. I said, I've discovered I'm actually quite a lazy person. And he said, well, how can you say you're lazy when for 17 years you got up at this ridiculous, ridiculous hour? And it was. And it was also very unhealthy. I mean, I think I'm very, very healthy now. But gee, for so many years, I was just no energy. And you know, the doctors will tell you it is unhealthy. And it was. But preparation is the key to good performance on radio. I met a guy called Alan Jones, who is the sort of a legend of Australian radio, talk radio. Very, very controversial guy. But in terms of discipline and professionalism, I learned so much from him. And he used to get into work at 4 o'clock. Mm. So I said, in my own naive Irish way, I said, well, if he's the best and he gets in at 4 o'clock, I'm going to get in at 3 o'clock. So that's what I did. I got in at 3 o'clock for a 6 o'clock show, 3 hours flat out preparation. And of course, once I built that up as my routine, I couldn't then go back and shorten it or do it, because I would have felt so bad.
You raised the bar so high.
It went well, yeah. And also, I think fear of failure and nerves and all sorts of things had something to do with it. You know, they say when you lose the nerves, you know, 10 seconds, 9 seconds, 8 seconds before that red light goes on air, then it's time to go. And I actually got more nervous as I went through it. But I think that the preparation was absolutely key. And I've enjoyed doing other things now. I times miss being on the radio. It's lovely to have a platform to put views across and to help people. And there's a lot of people who need helping. But you know, all things come to an end, and you have to hand on the baton, and that's what I've done in a very, very professional way, and 702 are magnificent to me, and yeah, I'm happy looking back.
So I see you're on Twitter. Do you enjoy Twitter? Do you find it? I mean, for me, I find it a bit toxic and a bit scary. Is that kind of your social media spot?
I hate Twitter with a passion undying. I think it is one of the parts of the spawn of the devil. I think what I don't know what it is about Twitter that just brings out the worst in almost everybody. You know, I can say to you, gee, that's a nice studio you've got, because I'm looking at you, you know, on the video here, and someone, I can tweet that, and someone will come. Three tweets later, it's a racist, sexist, bigoted, you know, a conversation. It's terrible. What happened was, though, I tweeted on 702, or my Alistair Teeling Smith, who is the program director. He used to listen to the program and tweet information. I never put anything for controversy's sake or anything like that. You know, on the John Robbie Show, the Minister of Finance said the following, and we put it out. And when I retired, amazingly, I had 400,000 something followers. And my kids, who are much more savvy about this sort of stuff than I am, said, you've got to take this with you, Dad. You never know what it'll mean. And 702 are great, and said, as long as I took the 702, you know, handle or whatever you call it, moniker or name off it, I could keep it. And now it's grown to 482,000 or something. So every so often when something just grabs me, I'll just put it up. Something that's nice, something that might be of interest. For example, I don't know if you've seen on Netflix this incredible documentary about the octopus.
I saw you tweet it.
I watched this thing, and it's like totally and utterly unique. It is mind-blowing, and it's a South African thing. It's gone all over the world. But I thought that's the sort of thing that a lot of people would like. Something politically comes up that I want to make just a little comment about, I'll do it there without saying, look, I'm fully involved. I don't want to have a great conversation, but I'm still out here and I'm still an observer. So that's what I do. And as I say, it's grown, and it's a necessary evil. It's out there and it's a necessary evil, but it's so sad that it's abused in so many ways. What started off as such a wonderful idea, I think, has been abused. And yeah, that's a pity, but it is what it is.
Yeah, because I mean, I think in a student's aspect, I mean, Twitter can literally define your life. I mean, we've seen over the past few months, especially in recent political times, how kids have been cancelled and kids have been completely and utterly cut off and in a sense ruined their reputation, rightfully or wrongfully so. I mean, cancel culture, in a sense, is very, very dangerous, and Twitter is promoting that.
It is, and it's one of these I mean, it's the old thing, you know, where do you draw the line between hate speech and freedom of speech, you know? And of course, you know, it's like so many things that it is in its simplicity and its essence is the most unbelievable example of freedom of speech. And you look at things like the Arab revolt that took place in the Arab countries and so on. This was led by social media, and it did a fantastic job. And as a way of passing information on, it's wonderful. But obviously there's a dark side of it as well. And I think the world is still learning how to police it, how to manage it. And of course, if everybody was as perfect as you and I are, then it would be wonderful. But as we know, that's not the case. And I'll certainly follow its development with a lot of interest. Mm.
So I think something that not many people, I mean, you say Clinton has told Clinton to shut up, and he's told you to shut up.
Oh, gee, you've done your research. 10 out of 10. Yeah, I often say, because I do quite a lot of public speaking and speaking at dinners and corporate events and MC work and so on. And I love to always say that Nelson Mandela told two people in public to shut up.
Yeah.
And one was Bill Clinton. When Bill Clinton, who was a great supporter of Mandela, but Bill Clinton was very angry when the ANC supported Cuba and Fidel Castro, you know, against the sanctions America had placed on it. And he told Bill Clinton to shut up and jump in the river. And I was very lucky enough at a media event in 1995 when Nelson Mandela was president, and they held a huge event for the media. And there were about 40 tables, and it was all SABC, you know, the national state media. And little old 702 and then MNET said, look, well, we're also media. Could we come along as well? So they gave us each a table tucked away in the corner. And very cheekily, I took the invitation and wrote a little message and asked one of the waiters, would he give it to Madiba? And I said, will you come and join us? We're at the far table. We'd like to speak to you as well. And I think I put this as a not a long walk, you know, joke. Redistribution of self. A couple of weak jokes, respectfully yours. And Nelson Mandela came over and he laughed and he looked up and we all cheered and he came and sat with us for an hour or over an hour. And you probably are too young to meet the great man. And he was one of the greatest men that ever lived. And he had this amazing ability, Nelson Mandela. When you met him, first of all, he was so big. His pictures do not give justice to the size of the man. They say when you met Muhammad Ali, it was the same. For some reason in his pictures, he didn't look as big as when you met him. He was a big, big man. And also he had this aura about him because he was the most famous human being in the world and probably the most loved. So most people, even incredibly educated or wealthy or whatever, famous, when they met Nelson Mandela, they got tongue-tied, and they would be gibbering like idiots. And everyone at the table was in that sort of forum. No one knew what to say to this great man sitting with us. So I said, well, I'm not going to waste the opportunity. So I said, Mr. President, could you answer a question, please? Almost like I was on the radio. And at the time, there was a lot of anger between the ANC and the IFP, and there was a lot of terrible things going on. And Chief Buthelezi, of course, was the leader. And Mandela hadn't met Buthelezi pointedly since he got out of jail. So I said, how come you can meet the old apartheid leaders? You had tea with Betsy Verwoerd, and yet you won't meet Chief Buthelezi. Oh, hang on now. Let me tell you. See, and he was like this. And of course, it used to be this banter on the radio. I'm saying, but hang on a second. Now, what about? He says, now, shut up. The table went like this. And then he smiled. He says, you are not on the radio now. That's one of my proudest boasts.
Yeah, I can imagine. When I look at rugby to radio, I mean, I think completely polarized different industries. I mean, are they that polarized? Do you think your rugby career shaped, in a sense, your radio career? Okay, so are we back?
Hello, sorry. Like somebody else phoned, and for some reason it came in there. I did get your question. And funnily enough, a lot of people say that. How did you go from one, you know, from rugby to radio? Totally different.
It's probably getting another call. You're popular. Sorry, you're popular.
Yeah, popular. Probably saying I'm listening to you. You know, when you actually think about it, there is a massive similarity. If you think about it, although one is not physical, obviously rugby is physical, but the higher up you go, believe it or not, it's more cerebral. Mm-hmm. And sorry, my watch keeps banging against the table. But if you think about it, rugby is about huge preparation, and then it's about performance, and then it's about result and feedback. And in a funny way, that's why a lot of sports people battle when they give up their passion at the age of 35 or whatever. They suddenly have to find something. And it was, It was one of the rugby players said to me, he said, it's not difficult finding a job, but finding a job that turns you on when you've run out in front of 80,000 people in a Rugby World Cup final is very, very difficult. And this is what I had found. What the heck am I going to do when I've been so passionate about rugby? Then I got into radio and loved it because there's that element of performance, a lot of preparation. You get feedback in terms of numbers, people who are listening to you, and you know, there's the results. How many people are you? The book comes out every couple of months, etc. So in a funny way, I was able to take my personality, which I'd expressed through rugby and satisfied through rugby, and then was able to do something very, very similar with radio. So in a funny, funny sort of way, they were absolutely perfect for one another. And to this day, I mean, I can't say how grateful and lucky I was to find that match of careers. And as a result, I've loved my work for the last, 40-something years.
Brilliant. So we're in conversation with John Robbie. We are getting your questions. I mean, we're having streams and streams of just, I love you, John. Like, you define, I mean, my gran, actually.
Oh, you lie like a cheap carpet. You lie like a cheap carpet.
I promise you.
Tell me the nasty ones.
I will tell you my gran's one. She said to me, please tell John he was an inspiration to me and so many. You know, I mean, for so many people, I mean, thank you, John Robbie. I listen to you every single morning. John, you are incredible. Thank you for everything. John, I love you. John, hello.
I'm embarrassed. The nicest thing is that when I started, a lot of people didn't like me. And a lot of particularly white people, maybe more conservative people, hated me. The same people who sent that horrible letter to me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the death threats and the insults, and there are a lot of them and so on. And now so many people in a shopping center or having a drink or some meal will come up to you and say, hey, John, by the way, hell, I didn't used to like you. But, you know, looking back, You actually prepared me for what was happening. You knew, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And even once at a golf club, at Irene Golf Club, I was doing a function on a Sunday at a golf day, and some people wanted to kill me. They were members of the AWB, right-wing group, and they actually wanted to beat. They said to Sun International, if John Robbie gives out the prizes, we're going to kill him. And this is at a golf day on a Sunday afternoon, absolutely bizarre. And it was very scary. My wife, Jenny, was with me at the time. And it was a nasty, nasty situation. People had moved off to the function. We were on our own at the tables outside with this group of people. And they were huge. It was a serious, serious thing. And then about a couple of years ago, the chairman of Irene said, look, they've got a member who says he was one of those guys. And he's so embarrassed about it. And looking back, he is so... I said, I'd love to meet the guy. I'd love to shake his hand and have a beer with him. He says, no, he's too embarrassed. But it's kind of nice now that an awful lot of people from all sorts of backgrounds say, and this is what I'm getting at. I mean, I'm not saying 702 freedom fighters, you know, risking lives on the front line. But what we did was we took a stand for truth, for democracy, and for honesty, I think. And we stuck by it. Yeah. And I think a lot of people now said, hang on a second, we can get through this, when people had no hope at all. And that's why I think 702 has got a huge role to play today, because there's an awful lot of pessimism about it. A lot of people are very down, are thinking of leaving the country or leaving the country. And I think by getting to the bottom of things and setting a balance of where we are, what's possible, where we're going, holding people to account, interpreting things, I think there's a similar role to play going forward. But, even as I'm talking, you're getting some goosebumps. Yeah.
I had a prep school teacher about 2 days ago when we announced we were interviewing you, and she said, Tom, do you remember used to when you didn't understand something? Because obviously I listened to you in the car on the way to school, and she said, and I would look up at the teacher and just try and explain something to me, and I wasn't getting it, and I'd say, ma'am, cut the slush, I don't get it. I don't get what you're saying. So, I mean, these lines, tell them I sent you. I mean, those are like in today's language and talk.
Always good on a Friday. Always good on a Friday. Thank goodness it's Friday. That was another one. Will you stop saying that? TGIF, thank goodness it's Friday. And I said, I will stop saying that when these crooks have been held to account. So I think if I was on the radio, I'd still be saying, thank goodness it's Friday.
Yes. So, I mean, we've got about another 2 minutes with you. I just wanted to ask, what's your playlist? What does John listen to over the weekend?
Funnily enough, I listen to a lot of Irish music, a lot of traditional Irish music and Irish rock music as well. I've discovered something called Spotify, which I never thought I'd be able to work, and I do that. I'm a great reggae fan. Bob Marley and the Wailers are my absolute favorite music. I hate hip-hop music and modern music. I just don't get it. I'm afraid rap music, I don't get it. In fact, on the radio, I used to refer to it as young. I used to say, what's this C-rap that people are talking about? C-rap, crap. You know, C-rap. C-rap. What's a C-rap? And, you know, this was my little joke, you know, that I'd throw out that. Probably be slaughtered for it today. And a lot of the old music, you know. I love 60s, 70s music. We all love the era that we were in. So, you know, so many groups are out, the Beatles, etc., Rolling Stones, stuff like that. Absolutely love it. But I love music. I just unfortunately can't play a note or sing a note.
So, I mean, parting words to any young budding radio presenter that wants to get into the industry, what would be your top tip?
My top tip would be, get your toe in the door. Everyone says, I want to be on radio. Mandy Wiener, one of our greatest journalists at the moment, got into 702 by becoming the traffic reporter's assistant. She got in doing that, what must have been the most banal, lowly paid job, just to get into 702. When she got in 702, she sat on Katie Katapotis, the news editor's door, and said, I want to do news. I want to do news. I'm great. I'm fabulous. In the Christmas holidays, just to shut her up, they gave her, go and find out about this water shortage down in Houghton. Yeah. And she went down there on this, you know, absolutely basic job assignment, and she got mugged. Got mugged by a mugger. And she interviewed the mugger. Well, she got mugged and came back with an interview on a mugger.
What a story.
And she got in, and this is what it is. Get your toe in the door. Yeah. Find out out what you can do. There's so many things in radio. There's sales, there's marketing, there's the technical side, there's the producing side, there's the call screening side, so many things. But once you're in, you can prove yourself and learn about it. And you know, radio is about, it's about, I suppose, being unique and being yourself. But also, like all other professions, there's best practice. There's best practice, things you do, how you throw forward, you prepare, you read advertisements, you do all these sort of technical things. And once you get that format, as Dan Katz used to say, and so many people don't get that, the format sets you free. You've got the best practice of how to run a radio show with your team. The producers and call screeners are absolutely vital in talk radio. And once you obey the best rules, in between that, you can be yourself to your heart's content. And the other thing I'd say is that you know, anyone can do a show on a huge day. You know, 9/11, Nelson Mandela coming out of jail, COVID lockdown. Gee, everybody wants to hear radio. But on the day when nothing is happening, the day when it's absolutely quiet, you've got to work hard to find things, issues, events, people. So people listening think, gee, it's the same show. It's the same show. In other words, your average is right up there all along. And that's what that's the best piece of advice I would give. And also to enjoy it, to absolutely enjoy it as I did.
We originally, when I said, no, John Robbie's coming, my sign, the wall, next to our new studio that's getting built. So we'd love to invite you back to sign our wall.
And can I just say to you, I'm knocked out with your whole operation there.
Thank you.
We didn't have that at school when I was at school, I can tell you. And also to you, your preparation has been first class. The way you and your team have handled things is very, very good. And I suspect one day someone from 702 might be phoning you.
Thank you, John Robbie. Now we've got news with Danny Abra.